From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, now that the William Morris Endeavor Talent Agency has filed to take itself public, we get a rare look inside the belly of a Hollywood beast. And Randall Park and Ali Wong co-wrote and starred in the new Netflix movie, Always Be My Maybe. Wong, who's mostly been a stand-up comedian, plays a celebrity restaurateur.
I think when you're a chef that does this, like, hacky food, it's kind of like being a hacky comic, right? Where it's like, this doesn't taste good, even though it looks nice or whatever. And it's like, this is not funny, even though it sells tickets.
All that coming up on The Frame. Ali Wong and Randall Park have been friends since college, and Wong wrote for Fresh Off the Boat, the ABC sitcom that Park stars in. For years, they talked about making a romantic comedy together. In a 2016 profile of Wong in The New Yorker, she described it as our version of When Harry Met Sally. Now that idea has become a reality. Wong and Park star in the new Netflix movie Always Be My Maybe, and they co-wrote the screenplay with Michael Golomko. When Wong and Park stopped by The Frame Studios, she explained how the idea for Always Be My Maybe came together.
We hadn't talked about it in detail, and it wasn't until, you know, a little bit before I did that interview that I distinctly remember Randall saying, you know, we should really do this. At the time, I was writing on Fresh Off the Boat, and I hadn't spent that much time acting. Well, I had acted on camera a lot, but people didn't know me as an actress. And I thought Randall meant when he said we should really do this, I thought he meant, you know, I want you to and I to write a starring vehicle for me to do a rom-com with like Anne Hathaway or something. And then he was like, no, I think we should star in it and we should write it together.
That's very sweet that you thought not Anne Hathaway, Ali Wong.
Yeah.
Or if Anne Hathaway's unavailable, Ali Wong.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, I've known Ali for so long. I've always known she was a great actress on top of everything else that she does so great. And it was, you know, we're close friends. And my dream is always to work with my friends. So it was something that I really would have loved to have happen. But I didn't expect it to kind of happen the way it did from that New Yorker article.
Yeah, that kind of caught fire, right? I mean, how long did it take to actually come together? I mean, it's 3 years later, but in Hollywood time, that's actually not that slow.
Well, after that article got picked, after that section of the article got picked up by all these other outlets, we both got inundated with calls from just different people in the industry and studios, and there was just a lot of interest for this script. And we didn't have a script.
We didn't have a log line.
Yeah, we had nothing.
Yeah.
So what's worse, to have interest in a script that doesn't exist or have a script that exists that has no interest?
The position we were in was very unique, and we feel really lucky to have been in it. And Netflix took it off the table right away.
What was the movie that you wanted to get made? What was the story that was important to you? Because scripts go through evolutions, people have notes, you know. What was the core thing that you wanted to make sure you preserved?
I mean, we had always talked about like our When Harry Met Sally. It's a movie that we both loved, but we wanted to incorporate our parts of us, as much of us, you know, in our lives in it as possible, and just kind of tell an authentic romantic comedy.
What does that mean, authentic? Is that authentic to your lives, authentic to your culture? Authentic to who you are, because there's so many different ways.
Authentic to our experiences and our lives.
I don't know. I guess with the question of authenticity, it's really hard for me to talk about, but it just kind of all comes down to instinct, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, for example, for that meal in the beginning that young Sasha, my character, makes for herself, where it's like spam and rice and furikake, it's like, I didn't make a movie to be like, I want to make movie with authentic food moments, you know. But when it came down to talk to props about what that would look like, it's like, well, this is what feels right. You know, these are the clothes that feel right. This is the girlfriend. This is the dad that feels right, you know. And I guess because we care about authenticity, all of that will come through when it comes down to the decision. But we don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. We first and foremost, like for me at least, I just wanted to make a movie with my friends that tells a great story, you know, and all those details that speak to our desire to like have authenticity just it just comes through, hopefully, in a natural, authentic way.
But it's important to note that the spam is sliced exactly right, very even. And then the rice, when you plate your rice for your own meal that nobody is watching, you put it in a ramekin and invert it so it actually looks like it's in a restaurant. It's in a form. So right. It might be rice and spam, but it's presented as if it were in a restaurant.
Yeah, and that's something specific to her character and showing how she has like a love of presentation of food from the very beginning, you know. And that's not like necessarily like an Asian American growing up in San Francisco thing. That's a Sasha thing.
Right. But yeah. There's also this detail about, do you slice food with scissors or do you chop it with a knife, which is a cultural thing in terms of how people present food and chop food.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's funny because those things, when we wrote them, they didn't mean that much to me or carry that much weight. But now when we're hearing feedback, people are like, I love the scissors part. I love the part where they take off their shoes when they go in the house and carry their shoes. And then they put the shoes back on when they go to the backyard. And we're like,
none of those were things that we were like, okay, we got to have a scene where they're cutting food with scissors. You know, it wasn't that, but it was like we had a scene where the mom is cooking. And how does the mom cook? Well, my mom cooked like this. Okay, that makes sense. You know, I think that's how those kind of authentic moments made their way into the movie.
But in some cases, and certainly in Hollywood history, those moments are often incredibly hard to preserve. Mm-hmm. That there is such a bias to take any story that might be authentic to a certain group of people and make it white. I mean, there's no other way around
right.
it. That's the story that everybody, that's their default mechanism.
Well, that's why it's so important. People focus way too much, when the question comes about like diversity, they focus way too much on the talent on camera, you know? And it's like, I think people really have to be paying attention more and caring more about the people behind the camera. Because when you have people from like diverse perspectives behind the camera, it's like, it's not this battle. Then it's like, what more can you add to the scene to make it feel more real? And it's not this like, well, they should be wearing shoes in the house, or, you know, I want her to be eating a hamburger or something like that to make it feel more mainstream. I mean, it's just, it's
imagine
just really
cutting
easy.
A hamburger with scissors. That would have been so weird.
Coming up on The Frame, more of my conversation with Ali Wong and Randall Park, co-stars of the new film, Always Be My Maybe. We were as one, babe, for a moment in time. And it seemed everlasting that you would always be mine. Now you wanna be free, so I let you fly. Cause I know in my heart, babe, let's get back to my conversation with Ali Wong and Randall Park. They're the co-writers and co-stars of the new romantic comedy, Always Be My Maybe.
Why were you looking in my backseat?
I wasn't. I was just, my chiropractor says I gotta, you know, turn.
Look in the backseat?
Yeah.
Because we had sex back there?
Oh my God.
Well, that's why you were looking back there. I'm just calling you out on it. So what do you think? Seen it after all these years?
That it might be even smaller and grosser than I remember.
Hey, you better still be talking about my backseat.
When Park and Wong came by to discuss Always Be My Maybe, we talked about when their friendship began. And it was through a comedy and theater group that Park started in college called LCC.
It was an Asian American theater company at UCLA. We wanted to kind of put our play, you know, we wrote plays and wanted to have them perform. So we started this theater company and then just kept going. And then after I graduated is when Ali joined the theater company, and it was I think through those friends that we eventually met and became friends and realized we had very similar outlooks on comedy and just vibed really, really well. So that theater company was a big part of, well, a huge part of my life and definitely a part of our friendship early on.
Yeah, because the thing about that theater company was that we had to, every quarter, we had to write, direct, and like produce our own shows. Mm-hmm. So we had to do the tech and everything. So it already kind of made me really appreciate, like, I think everyone wanted to come to the theater group to just be funny on stage and make people laugh. But it's like, hey, you have to design flyers.
Yeah.
You have to pass out. You have to like do lighting cues and stuff too. Like, not everyone gets to just be funny and have all the funny lines. Some people have to be the straight man or something. And so having that like well-rounded appreciation for everything that goes in to like a successful comedic performance was huge. Because then when I started doing stand-up, it was like people found it so overwhelming to like put on their own stand-up show or something. And to me, I was like, oh, this is easy. We don't have mm-hmm. costumes. We don't have props. There's no lighting cues. Like, we just have to rent it. You know, it was, I think that was really, really valuable.
When you're doing stand-up, you know if a joke is working or not. You can hear the audience either laughing or silent. When right. you're writing with Randall on this movie, how do you know if something's funny? What is your test about whether or not it works?
Well, again, it's like a lot of instinct, right? So it's like the first line is like, do we find it funny? Mm-hmm. And then we had multiple table reads. You know, we put on a table read
early on
before yeah. Nanotchka was brought on. We had a table read very early on. We rented out this office space in Culver City and had a bunch of friends do us a big favor, come in. Mm-hmm. We gave them Amazon gift cards afterwards. And then we and learned a lot from that table read, but those table reads are so, it's like at Fresh Off the Boat too, we would do that. We would do these pre-table reads before we would do the actual table reads, mm-hmm. season one and two. And that was like your open mic, essentially.
Right. It's an audience, know? And if they're laughing, it's working. Mm-hmm. And if they're not silent.
Yeah. And if we had the resources and time, I mean, you know, for a script, I would be like, you should do a table read. Like, you should do like 30, you know, mm-hmm. before you get to shooting.
We're talking with Ali Wong and Randall Park, who both co-wrote and star in the movie Always Be My Maybe. There's a lot in this movie about food and about celebrity chefs. And there's a scene that I won't describe in a restaurant toward the end of the film that is unbelievably hilarious about this very cutting edge restaurant. Why was that important for you as a character to play? What does a chef allow you to do in terms of commenting on how that person sees her own work and the world?
I think it's the easiest way for me to talk about what it's like to talk about voice without talking about it via stand-up comedy, because, you know, I think when you're like a chef that does this like hacky food, it's kind of like being a hacky comic, right? Where it's like, this doesn't taste good, even though it looks nice or whatever. And it's like, that's not funny, even though it sells tickets or whatever, or is making money. So it was just this profession that I've always been drawn to because it was the most analog thing to being a female stand-up comic, because you're surrounded in this industry by all these men, right? And you work nights. You work like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You can never go to a wedding. You can never go to a baby shower. And it's, you know, there's so much. It's all dependent on like your point of view, right? But at the same time, you have to keep innovating and doing new things, but the food still got to taste good and the jokes still have to be funny, you know?
Only because he's in the trailer, because I'm bound by law not to say what he does. Keanu Reeves is in your film. Let's listen to a clip from the trailer.
Hi, baby.
Hi, Mr. Flesh.
I missed your thighs.
I missed your beard scratching my thighs.
I missed your taste.
I missed your thumbs. You're so good with your thumbs.
Oh, man.
Went on for like 10 minutes. The best 10 minutes of my life. Yeah.
So that'll be on the director's cut? Or what happened?
I don't know. We'll see. Yeah.
What was it about casting Keanu, even though we can't say exactly who he plays, that made sense?
He was we had this role that we had written, and our ideal person to play that role was Keanu Reeves. Ideal. But we didn't think it was ever going to happen. So we had a number of other names as backups, a whole list. And, our producers were like, let's go out to Keanu. Let's just try it. And we were like, okay, whatever. It's not going to happen.
Worst he could say is no.
Yeah, well, he will say no. He won't even respond, most likely. And somehow it worked out. He said yes. And that was pretty amazing. And he was amazing to work with just throughout the whole process.
The title of the film comes from a Mariah Carey song, right? Is that where you got it?
Mm-hmm,
and there's a big element of music in this. Randall, your character is electrician, HVAC guy by day, rock band guy by night. But his music is very important to him. So how would you guys...
And also, I just want to note that Randall wrote every single word of those songs. And they're so funny and they're good and they're delightful. And
well, Dan the Automator, who produced those songs from the band, is a legendary Bay Area producer and musician, and he certainly helped make those songs really good.
But why was music important to you as a character? What was it about what he's doing and the happiness he gets from playing small clubs and having people love his music that felt integral to the story?
Well, that was something that came from real life. There was a time when I was in a band very similar to the band you see in the movie.
And what was its name?
It was called Illigan. And we were this kind of small local band that just loved. I mean, and we, you know, we were, I don't know if we were that good, but we were having.
They were really good.
Did you see them?
All the time. Yeah. Yeah. Not all the time, but like, I remember seeing them a lot while I was in college, and I loved it.
I'm a dialect derelict front like I'm arrogant. Chumps get embarrassed when I'm bumped in a chariot. Various vats full of raps for your merriment. Made monks in a monastery get gregarious. I got flow similar to snot out the nostrils. Aficionados call me Pablo Picasso, shock those body out.
Yeah, it was fun, and we, you know, we'd fill the clubs in LA, and it was just a great time, but we weren't very ambitious. We were very happy with kind of where we were at, and this band kind of represents what, you know, what would have happened if that band kind of kept playing into their adulthood, into their, you know, 30s, and the band would probably be like the one you see in the movie.
This is a movie that is obviously very personal to you and personal to your lives and influenced by things that you guys have done. And yet, unfairly, so many of these stories are seen as like referendums on a bigger idea, that it becomes the poster child for, can we do a romantic comedy where both the leads are Asian?
Yeah, hopefully people will be so taken by the story. If it works, you know, and people relate to it and people laugh at it and are into it and are invested in the characters, that they won't be distracted by that conversation, you know, because it was so interesting. Like, I mean, for example, like with stand-up, I was shocked at like how much people didn't ask me about my race or compare me to Margaret or anything like that. And so because I think
Margaret Cho.
Yeah. You know, and because I love her, and I grew up watching her, and she's dirty too, but in no interview did anybody ever ask me about her. And I was relieved by it, even though I love to talk about Margaret, you know, so I'm hoping that the same will happen with our film. And then if people want to compare or put it in this other context, then we can get to it. But hopefully not, you know, because I think that other directors, you know, who make, like Quentin Tarantino doesn't have that pressure, or other people. I mean, I'm not Quentin Tarantino, but, you know, other people who make movies, they don't have that on them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Randall?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we just made a movie that we like and we feel good about, and yeah, whatever comes is going to come. But ultimately, we didn't do it for that. But if that conversation does come, you know, that's fine too, because that's a part that's in the zeitgeist, and that's a part of where we're at right now. So, but hopefully, people just say, "Wow, that was a great movie," and we really identified with those characters.
Allie and Randall, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always Be My Maybe is in select theaters starting today. It hits Netflix on May 31st. Coming up, the William Morris Endeavor Talent Agency is planning to go public, which means we get a rare look at the finances of a Hollywood powerhouse. Last week, William Morris Endeavor filed papers to go public. The talent agency's finances already were under scrutiny because the Writers Guild of America is clashing with WME and other big agencies over packaging fees. I spoke with Variety's business editor, Cynthia Littleton, and we started with a merger in 2009 that brought together the established William Morris with the upstart talent agency, Endeavor.
William Morris was an absolute institution, and it was one of the entities that helped shape the entertainment industry as we know it. As time went on, though, the feeling was that it had sort of ossified from the inside. It very much needed the new leadership and the kind of fresh, brash, upstart mentality that Endeavor brought in droves. William Morris also had a deep bench of material that just churn out cash.
The Andy Griffith Show.
From shows like you know, the Andy Griffith Show that are still just printing money today. So William Morris had this great resource, but they didn't have the current leadership that could take the agency into the future.
The thing I remember, too, is just like what the architecture of the two firms said. You went into William Morris. It was kind of dark, a lot of like big leather seats, felt very old-fashioned. You go into Endeavor, it was like gleaming, open floors. It just felt like they had different views of what an agency should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a reason why people know the name Ari Emanuel. He was definitely the inspiration for the Jeremy Piven's Ari Gold character on Entourage.
You have until the end of the day tomorrow to agree to be rebranded mine.
And that is definitely not, that is not the attitude or the mentality or the visuals that you found, as you say, going into the old William Morris agency.
I've always been interested, and you probably have been as well, about how much agents make, because it's always been a pretty closely guarded secret. But when you go public, you have to file a lot of financial disclosures. And I look through the numbers, and they're pretty staggering. So last year, Ari Emanuel, the CEO, made $5.3 million. But those numbers don't even include the value of vested and unvested equity in the firm. For Emanuel last year, it was valued at an additional $85 million. And if you go back a year before that, WME bought back from Emanuel $165 million of equity that he held. What have you taken away in terms of the compensation that the agents are making as revealed in these papers?
Well, I think you have to separate the senior agents at William Morris versus what are now corporate officers of the larger Endeavor holding company, which has a lot of different pieces. But yes, these are more, you know, eight and nine figure kind of jaw-dropping figures. This goes back to the idea that even 10 years ago that the smaller, although very strong and upstart agency Endeavor could take over the larger William Morris agency. Even that struck many as like, you know, kind of a head scratcher in terms of how did they pull that off? And then you see the kind of equity that is accrued to the top people, Ari Emanuel and Patrick Weitzel, and you just realize, you know, there was such a gold rush there 10 years ago, and it's much greater than the sum of the parts that they inherited in 2009.
You wrote that the timing of their plans to go public is not perfect. What are the problems with it? Why is this not a great time for WME to be trying to take itself public?
Well, there's another big issue that is roiling Hollywood right now, which is this split between Hollywood writers that create films and TV shows with Hollywood's largest talent agencies, of which WME is the biggest. And that is kind of something that nobody really saw coming even just a few months ago. I think people thought that there would be a flap and it would be settled quickly. And we're going on now 7 weeks and it hasn't been settled. This is bad news for the largest agencies because the top screenwriters and showrunners are their most valuable clients because nothing happens without a script.
When I look through the securities filing, it occurs to me that given all the other kind of unusual businesses that WME is in now, it's got like a sports betting business. It's got Miss Universe. It has professional bull riders. Do they really need writers? Can they survive with those other businesses? How much of their old way of making money is critical to their future?
You know, there has been a lot of speculation that they might spin out WME as a separate entity. You know, Endeavor insiders have said absolutely not. We will not separate WME from the rest of the businesses. It still seems like that could be a plausible path for certainly settling some of the issues that arise from WME being corporately connected with all these companies that are in content and distribution. People have been saying conflicts of interest for a long time. That chorus has gotten louder with the stuff that's in the air about the WGA, about the general concerns about the way that the WME and its larger rivals have been evolving in a changing entertainment ecosystem. It's really fraught.
As part of their filing to go public, they have this thing called Talent Case Study, Dwayne Johnson, and they talk about representing Dwayne Johnson since 2011, and they talk about his movies, but they also talk about all the other things WME has been doing with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. There's a YouTube channel with more than 3 million subscribers. And then there's an event coming to Atlanta in June of next year called the Rock Games, a fitness, lifestyle, and entertainment convention experience. Is WME doing things that other agencies aren't? Are they thinking outside the box? Is that why they're so successful?
That's one of their big selling points, is that they organically have a lot of relationships outside of the core Hollywood film and television business that clients like Dwayne Johnson, as opposed to, you know, the ideal in Hollywood used to be the $10 million, the $20 million actor. But really, now it's the Ellen DeGeneres's, it's the Dwayne Johnson's, it's the people that can be, that can, you know, play in a lot of different sandboxes.
Cynthia Littleton is the business editor at Variety. Cynthia, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, John.
And that is all for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.